Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Members of Congress and immigration activists blocked the entrance to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection headquarters Wednesday, protesting the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border. This from L.A. Times. 10 House members, including Representatives Judy Chu, Jimmy Gomez, John Lewis, Joseph Crowley, and Luis Gutierrez, wore white armbands to signify their intention to be arrested in an act of civil disobedience. The representatives sought to draw attention to a policy many of them called immoral and inhumane. Representative Pramila Jayapal said the issue had not received the congressional scrutiny it deserved. Gutierrez told a crowd of about 200 people at Freedom Plaza, quote, "I cannot think of an act that is more cruel and more inhumane than to rip a child from the arms of a mother," end quote. Jayapal said that on Saturday she visited migrant mothers being held in a federal detention center south of Seattle. Quoting again, "What I saw," she said, "was outrageous, inhumane, cruel, unethical. They were told they were going to take showers or be photographed, and when they came back, their children were no longer there. In many cases, they were standing in a room right next to them. They could hear them screaming for them," end quote. Spurred on by Lewis' command to get in a little good trouble, the crowd flooded the intersection of 14th Street in Pennsylvania, walking against traffic towards the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center, which houses the headquarters of the Border Patrol Agency. More to that article at LA Times. On the same topic from Agence France-Presse, U.S. Senate Democrats on Tuesday demanded an end to forced separation of undocumented immigrant children from their parents, introducing legislation that would ban the controversial practice undertaken by the Trump administration. 32 Democrats in the Republican-controlled Senate are sponsoring the Keep Families Together Act, which imposes a prohibition on separation of such immigrant families. The bill's a long shot. No Republicans are sponsoring the legislation, and congressional leaders have given no indication that they will hold votes on the bill. So this is where I depart from the text and way forth. It's not hard to take the correct moral stance on this. It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's reprehensible. It's frankly, in terms of human relations, it is degenerate. It is repulsive. It is putrescent. I can't think of enough adjectives to come up with this. And I have some more from the non-corporate press on this situation. And frankly, it's beyond belief, almost. But it is a return of fascistization, and it is reminiscent very much of the internment of Japanese citizens during the conflict of World War II. It's reminiscent of a number of horrific things, and the fact that the Republicans won't even talk about it, won't even sponsor the legislation, tells you where they're coming from. That and President Trump's comments, for example, praising the dictator, the monster Duterte in the Philippines, praising the monster dictator Kim in North Korea. What does President Trump really admire? What does he want to be? Clearly, a monster dictator. And he's got a good start on it, hasn't he? So the question is, are we going to tolerate it? Is that okay with you? That's what your flag stands for. But returning to the texts of the articles, again from Agence France-Presse, the move has sparked domestic and international criticism, including from the United Nations, which demanded a halt to what it called a serious violation of children's rights. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon told reporters, quote, "The Statue of Liberty under the Trump policy is not carrying a torch, it's carrying a pair of handcuffs," end quotes. I'll turn to commondreams.org for the third take on this. From Jake Johnson, he writes, "As the heart-wrenching story of a Honduran mother having her baby daughter ripped from her arms by federal authorities as she was breastfeeding provided yet another example of the immense cruelty of President Donald Trump's family separation policy, Representative Pramila Jayapal on Wednesday led a sit-in outside the offices of Customs and Border Patrol, demanding that asylum seekers be released from government detention and reunited with their loved ones immediately. Quoting Jayapal, "Every hour that goes by is another hour of trauma for these moms, dads, little boys, girls, and babies." And Representative Jan Schakowsky added, "What do you call a country that institutionalizes child abuse?" "Tragically, today," she said, "we call it the United States of America. As a mother, as a grandmother, and as the proud daughter of two immigrant parents, we will not stand for that. We will fight until we win," end quote. Your comments and questions on that topic, 503-231-8187. And here's a question for you. What happens to those who have sealed a deal with Donald Trump? We can turn to his life history for the answer. They are betrayed. The minority president has reneged on every major agreement in his life. He's filed bankruptcy many times in order to avoid taking responsibility for his disastrous business dealings from England to Atlantic City. He has always had the retinue of the very rich around him, and that coterie has ensured that claimants against his false promises are met with evasions, legalisms, and denial. He told the white working class that he would restore the coal industry and that he would bring prosperity for them with new manufacturing plants, and those statements are clearly lies. The deal with North Korea is no different. Clear your head for a moment and consider the facts. There is no nuclear deal. And it doesn't matter what he says, of course, because we know just how much we can trust what Trump says. There is no change in the war footing with North Korea. After exacerbating the situation with blustering threats for more than a year, both dictators, as Fox News said, have met in Singapore. That is exactly what Kim Jong-un has been demanding for years. In fact, the legitimacy dealt to the North Korean leader is so important that he created a movie about it years ago. Excuse me, the movie is called The Country I Saw. The Country I Saw, produced by Chosun Films in North Korea in five parts. With the most recent segment in 2012, it has an American president being forced to the negotiation table after an escalation in nuclear demonstrations by Pyongyang. That was 6 years ago. It's really what Kim wants and needs, and he's been very clear about that. With that in mind, consider the mainstream media's frame that Trump has used some sort of amazing persuasion to get Kim Jong-un to the table. It's the opposite of the truth. Kim Jong-un has been openly pining for such a meeting for years. Obama considered it and was rebuked by the Republican Congress. This is not a difficult feat. It's very important to Kim Jong-un that he be seen as the leader who makes this fantasy a reality. It's part of the propaganda matrix in North Korea. Similarly, the American presidency has produced a short film to propagandize directly from the White House. Who needs news? Who needs reporting? Who needs journalism when you can do direct propaganda? It praises the summit as a masterful stroke and a game changer for the world. It saddens me to see people falling for this sort of direct mind control. It's terrific that Trump blurted out a major concession, postponing the annual war games, but that's just an artifact of Trump's narcissism, and it won't last. Trump's goal is not peace. Rather, it is his fantasy of being awarded a Nobel Prize and thereby achieving the sort of legitimacy that will lead to his reelection. In this, he is exactly like Kim Jong-un. He needed the spectacle. And again, there is no nuclear deal. I can prove that there will be no lasting peace in Korea in two words. John Bolton. He is the glowering man with the white mustache that you can see literally at the table in the video records of the meeting in Singapore. He has not changed his mind about warmongering in any way. He is on his mission to make certain there is a war. Let me remind you of who John Bolton is. Pardon me. He is a powerful man. He controls millions of dollars. He's been a Fox pundit. Millions of dollars in political action committee money, and he's been doling it out over the years to pro-war candidates, including Donald Trump. Bolton has loudly been demanding war, notably versus Iran, for years. As the UN ambassador for George Bush, Bolton was known for his militaristic bombast. He hasn't changed one stripe on his tail. He wants war. He represents war interests, lobbies, and agitates for war, and he is at Trump's side constantly. Here's what Bolton said to Fox News' Chris Wallace. In April, in a friendly interview, Wallace asked, will President Trump insist that Kim give up, ship out all of his nuclear weapons, all of his nuclear fuel, all of his ballistic missiles before the U.S. makes any concessions? And Bolton replied, yes, I think that's what denuclearization means. We have very much in mind the Libya model from 2003, 2004, end quote. Now, Bolton knows better than almost anyone how inflammatory the reference to Libya was. Kim Jong-un himself has mentioned Libya as the reason for his nuclear buildup. Bolton was trying to blow up the talks right there by saying publicly, and thus to Kim Jong-un, that the U.S. would like to deceive him into giving up his nuclear weapons so that the U.S. could then betray him unto death, as was the case with Libya's leader Gaddafi. Does anyone really think that Kim Jong-un is so stupid as to fall for that? And Bolton must have been tearing his hair out when Trump gave away the war games without an initial pledge of denuclearization from Kim Jong-un. But Bolton plays the long game, and he is still there at Trump's side. And you can be sure that once Trump has the Nobel legitimacy that he so desires, the military confrontation with North Korea will continue and worsen. This does mean that there is a pause and a delay in military confrontation, which is a good thing. I'm happy about that. Anyone should be. But it's not over, and it won't be. And my criticism is from the left, unlike some that I have seen in the press, particularly from the Democrats. I'm not concerned that Trump isn't militaristic enough, far from it. I don't care about that. The war games should have been rolled back decades ago. And it is largely the war games that got us to where we are with the nuclear confrontation. But this isn't a real peace deal. There's no reason to think that it is. To think that this is a real peace deal, that things will really move forward, is to pretend that you know nothing about the actors in this drama. It's far more likely, given the shape of history under similar conditions, I'm thinking Stalin and Hitler, who also admired each other for being tough. That was the basis of their pact. I think it's far more likely that a secret deal will be worked out with Beijing along the lines of, you eat Taiwan and we'll eat North Korea up to the outskirts of Pyongyang. Want peace? Don't hold your breath. Comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Got a little bit more news you're not supposed to know, and then I want to spend the rest of this this time up to 10 o'clock Pacific talking about socialism, because I don't think socialism gets talked about enough, and I have some opinions. The time is 9:12 Pacific. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Rank-and-file Teamsters, according to the Socialist Worker, have shown they're ready to take on UPS after members voted to authorize a strike by a more than 90% margin at the end of May. The vote has been a long time coming. It gives voice to workers' frustrations with a company that prioritizes its extreme profits over wages and working conditions. Now, I'm quoting from an article that is penned by an anonymous Teamster. The question, they write, however, remains whether the union administration of General President James P. Hoffa and local Teamster leaders are prepared to use this potential rank-and-file power to really take on UPS. UPS contracts in package and freight expire at the midnight of July 31st. What will happen on August 1st? Here are the three most likely outcomes. First, there could be a tentative agreement that would be voted on by Teamsters membership. Second, a contract extension is possible. This happened during the last round of negotiations in 2013. Or third, a national strike could be called by the Teamster leadership, sending 260,000 UPS Teamsters to the picket line and shutting down a sizable portion of the logistics network in the U.S. And speaking for myself, if you're a union member like me, you do not cross a picket line. You do not cross a picket line. Returning to the text, the August 1997 strike at UPS, the only time UPS Teamsters went on a nationwide strike, had a major impact on other business in the U.S. economy. Skipping ahead, package car drivers are doing far more stops than before and are monitored electronically by management while being forced to work excessive mandatory overtime. Inside hub workers are intimidated to work faster. There is a shortage of inside workers due to the low start pay of $10 an hour. Here again, I want to depart from the text. You cannot make a living. You cannot raise a family on $10 an hour. Absolutely not. Rents are much higher than that. Groceries are higher than that. You can't make it. It's time to fight. Returning to the text, new hires quit on a regular basis after they realize that other low-paying jobs might not be as back-breaking and have better start pay. Still, with an unemployment low and a far higher volume of packages due to e-commerce, UPS Teamsters have the potential of using leverage we have now to make substantial gains in this contract. But, the author writes, we have to use our power. And the leadership of the Teamsters is standing in the way of this. Skipping ahead, meanwhile, UPS is making profits hand over fist. Again, this is from the Socialist Worker. Look it up. You're not going to be offered it in a search unless you look for it directly. UPS is making profits hand over fist. UPS CEO David Abney's pay has more than tripled during the current contract, as Teamsters for a Democratic Union pointed out. Last year, UPS paid Abney, ready for it, $14.6 million in total compensation, or just over $7,000 an hour. Remember that when the company pleads poverty in contract negotiations. Skipping ahead, the best way to win is to strike. We can't let Hoffa and Taylor settle short and claim victory. It'll be up to the rank and file, TDU and Teamsters United, to put pressure on those Teamster leaders. Teamsters United is calling for contract unity actions at UPS hubs from June 18th, that's Monday, to June 21st to show the company that members won't accept a weak contract. They write, we deserve far more than Hoffa and Taylor are proposing, and we can force the company to give us a great contract like we did in 1997, but only if we use our power, the power to withhold our labor and strike. You're listening to Press Watch. This is KBOO Portland. Here's the number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Albert Einstein's in the news. Albert Einstein's in the news for his racist views in the 20s, in his diary. His private writings have come to light, and they're nasty, and they are racist. But Albert Einstein, by the 30s, had turned that around in a big way and was a champion against whiteness, a champion for people of color in the United States, and he was a friend of James Robeson. He stood up for W.E.B. Du Bois and thwarted an attempt to frame Du Bois in a way that, given the context, he might not have survived. Albert Einstein was a champion for the people, all the people, and he was against whiteness. And he was also a commie. J. Edgar Hoover hated him for it and spied on him constantly, trying to prove that he was part of the international communist conspiracy. Well, he wasn't, but he was a communist. He was a socialist. And Albert Einstein wrote in Monthly Review in 1949 an explanation of socialism, and I believe it is still relevant today. So I'm going to be passing that on. And as I read it, I invite your calls on the topic of socialism, on the topics of the news that I have brought earlier in the broadcast, specifically the detention and separation of families by way of terrorizing people at the border under the Trump administration, the fascism of the Trump administration, the Teamsters' possible strike coming up versus UPS, union organizing generally, and, okay, it looks like before I get started with Albert Einstein, I'll talk to Lynn. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
So I'm sorry I haven't heard the whole show, but I tuned in when you were talking about the $10 an hour wage and nobody can live on that, et cetera.
That's right.
And you said it's time to fight, right?
Yep.
Okay, well, somebody's got an issue with their boss, but they can't do it right now, and they just want to maybe make a statement with bosses in general. There is going to be a big picket at the Burgerville on 82nd and Gleason. They just fired the third of three organizers for, you know, nonsense union busting. And so that picket's going to be between 5 and 7 tomorrow afternoon.
5 and 7 tomorrow afternoon at the Burgerville, did you say, on 82nd?
82nd and Gleason, yep.
82nd and Gleason versus unfair labor practices, firing people in retaliation for being pro-union.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you very much for that information.
Thank you, Teresa. Keep it up.
I appreciate that. And the IWW has inspired the entire nation and the world with their actions versus Burgerville, and really hoping that that will go forward. By the way, don't fall for the ruse that it is necessary to raise the price of a commodity, or that one may raise the price of one's commodity offered on the general capitalist market when one must pay more for labor. That's not true at all. The price of a Burgerville burger is set by demand, supply and demand. And if it costs you more in terms of labor, you can't raise the price of your burger unless you deem that you have that much slack within the demand for your burger. It's the demand for your burger which is changing in the Portland market. There are other burgers and certainly better burgers available. So don't fall for that. The first thing that you will hear is like, oh my God, that'll raise the price of the burgers. Nope. They might be raised as a gesture of retaliation, as an attempt to inflame the public, but not only is it not necessary, but it's a bad move to raise the price of your burger outside of market forces. If you want to understand socialism, you better understand capitalism. So let's talk about socialism. Albert Einstein wrote in Monthly Review 1949, "Is it advisable," he asked, "for one who is not an expert in economic and social issues to express views on the subject of socialism? I believe for a number of reasons that it is. Let us first consider," he wrote, "the question from the point of view of scientific knowledge. It might appear that there are no essential methodological differences between astronomy and economics. Scientists in both fields attempt to discover laws of general acceptability for a circumscribed group of phenomena in order to make the interconnection of these phenomena as clearly understandable as possible. But in reality, such methodological differences do exist. The discovery of general laws in the field of economics is made difficult by the circumstance that is observed that observed economic phenomena are often affected by many factors which are hard to evaluate separately. In addition, the experience which has accumulated since the beginning of the so-called civilized period of human history has, as is well known, been largely influenced and limited by causes which are by no means exclusively economic in nature. For example, most of the major states of history owed their existence to conquest. The conquering peoples established themselves legally and economically as the privileged class of the conquered country. They seized for themselves a monopoly of the land ownership and appointed a priesthood from among their own ranks. The priests in control of education made the class division of society into a permanent institution and created a system of values by which the people were thenceforth, to a large extent, unconsciously guided in their social behavior. But," Albert Einstein wrote, "historic tradition is, so to speak, of yesterday. Nowhere have we really overcome what Thorstein Veblen called the predatory phase of human development. The observable economic facts belong to that phase, and even such laws as we can derive from them are not applicable to other phases. Since the real purpose of socialism is precisely to overcome and advance beyond the predatory phase of human development, economic science in its present state can throw little light on the socialist society of the future." Now, speaking for myself, I think it's interesting that you have a great mind addressing socialism and capitalism and putting it that way. Think particularly of the Chicago School of Economics, that great scam and apologia foisted upon humanity. What does Albert Einstein say? Socialism. 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 I love to say that on a microphone. A microphone connected live to a transmitter, blasting that word out with 25,000 watts. The word is being heard over Cascadia and via the web across the world. And I like that because there has been so much work to undermine, obfuscate, and destroy socialism. And that's because if people really look at how badly capitalism has failed, they will turn to another system. And we have to know where we're going, I think. We can't just react to circumstances. Therefore, I'm a socialist. I am an anarcho-socialist, to be specific, and in this societal context, that simply means that I am grudging of vanguardism. So to return to Albert Einstein's writing. Second, socialism is directed towards a social ethical end. Science, however, cannot create ends, and even less, instill them in human beings. Science at most can supply the means by which to attain certain ends, but the ends themselves are conceived by personalities with lofty ethical ideals and, if these ends are not stillborn but vital and vigorous, are adopted and carried forward by those many human beings who, half unconsciously, determine the slow evolution of society. For these reasons, we should be on our guard not to overestimate science and scientific methods when it is a question of human problems, and we should not assume that experts are the only ones who have a right to express themselves on questions affecting the organization of society. Innumerable voices have been asserting for some time now that human society is passing through a crisis, that its stability has been gravely shattered. It is characteristic of such a situation, that individuals feel indifferent or even hostile toward the group, small or large, to which they belong. In order to illustrate my meaning, Einstein wrote, let me record here a personal experience. I recently discussed with an intelligent and well-disposed man the threat of another war, which in my opinion would seriously endanger the existence of mankind, and I remarked that only a supranational organization would offer protection from that danger. Thereupon my visitor very calmly and coolly said to me, quote, why are you so deeply opposed to the disappearance of the human race, end quote. I am sure that as little as a century ago, no one would have so lightly made a statement of this kind. It is the statement of a man who has striven in vain to attain an equilibrium within himself and has more or less lost hope of succeeding. Is it the expression of a painful solitude and isolation from which so many people are suffering in these days? What is the cause? Is there a way out? It is easy to raise such questions, but difficult to answer them with any degree of assurance. I must try, Einstein wrote, however, as best as I can, although I am very conscious of the fact that our feelings and strivings are often contradictory and obscure, and that they cannot be expressed in easy and simple formulas. Man is, at one and the same time, a solitary being and a social being. As a solitary being, he attempts to protect his own existence and that of those who are closest to him, to satisfy his personal desires, and to develop his innate abilities. Again, this is Einstein writing in 1949 in the Argot of the day. As a social being, he seeks to gain the recognition and affection of his fellow beings, to share in their pleasures, to comfort them in their sorrows, and to improve their conditions of life. Only the existence of these varied, frequently conflicting strivings accounts for the special character of a man. Only the existence of these varied, frequently conflicting strivings account for the special character of a man, and their specific combination determines the extent to which an individual can achieve an inner equilibrium and can contribute to the well-being of society. It's quite possible that the relative strength of these two drives is in the main fixed by inheritance, but the personality that finally emerges is largely formed by the environment in which a man happens to find himself during his development, by the structure of the society in which he grows up, by the tradition of that society, and by its appraisal of certain particular types of behavior. The abstract concept society means to the individual human being the sum total of his direct and indirect relations to his contemporaries and to all people of earlier generations. The individual is able to think, feel, strive, and work by himself, but he depends so much upon society and his physical, intellectual, and emotional existence that it is impossible to think of him or to understand him outside the framework of society. It is society which provides man with food, clothing, a home, the tools of work, language, the form of thoughts, and most of the content of thought. His life is made possible through the labor and accomplishments of the many millions past and present who are all hidden behind that small word, society. This is writings of Einstein, rather sexist, of course, from 1949, and he is laying the groundwork for his examination of socialism, and of course, socialism versus capitalism in that frame. I have another caller. Craig is on the air. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Craig.
Yes, hello. I appreciate this very much, and I was going to read a short piece by Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Ferlinghetti's still alive. Ferlinghetti's going to celebrate his 100th birthday.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
How about that? Well, how short is it?
It's
I've got a lot of Einstein to go.
I've lost it.
Oh, no.
Can I call back? I apologize. I'm not very good at computers, and I had it up, and then I tried to go to turn you guys off so I could talk on the phone.
Right on. Really, okay. Apologize. Yeah, I understand. I do that all the time.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Call back.
Let me call right back.
All right.
As soon as I find it.
All right. I was reading from Einstein about socialism, and yes, it is the Einstein. He wrote, "It is evident, therefore, that the dependence of the individual upon society is a fact of nature which cannot be abolished, just as in the case of ants and bees. However, while the whole life process of ants and bees is fixed down to the smallest detail by rigid hereditary instincts, the social pattern and interrelationships of human beings are very variable and susceptible to change. Memory, the capacity to make new combinations, the gift of oral communication have made possible developments among human beings which are not dictated by biological necessities. Such developments manifest themselves in traditions, institutions, and organizations, in literature, in scientific and engineering accomplishments, and works of art. This explains how it happens that, in a certain sense, man can influence his life through his own conduct, and that in this process, conscious thinking and wanting can play a part." Einstein on socialism. "Man acquires at birth through heredity a biological constitution which we must consider fixed and unalterable, including the natural urges which are characteristic of the human species. In addition, during his lifetime, he acquires a cultural constitution, which he adopts from society through communication and through many other types of influences." And with that sentence, Einstein is trying to say, we are really, really set in our ways, in ways that really take some thought to parse. And Craig is back. So hi, Craig. Go ahead with Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Hi, yes, thank you. He said, "Pity the nation whose people are sheep and whose shepherds mislead them. Pity the nation whose leaders are liars, whose sages are silenced, and whose bigots haunt the airwaves. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and acclaim the bully as hero, and aims to rule the world with force and by torture."
That's rather prescient, don't you think?
"Pity the nation that knows no other language but its own, and no other culture but its own. Pity the nation whose breath is money, and sleeps the sleep of the too well fed. Pity the nation, oh, pity the people who allow their rights to erode and their freedoms to be washed away. My country, tears of thee, sweet land of liberty."
He wrote that quite a while ago.
Yes, he did. But how perfectly appropriate it is for today, unfortunately.
Ferlinghetti, the last beat, criticized the genocidal actions versus Hiroshima and Nagasaki, went there himself, and has been quite an influence. Thank you very much for sharing some Ferlinghetti.
Thank you.
Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. I have been reading from Albert Einstein's contribution to a magazine article in 1949, defending socialism, because Einstein was a commie. "So am I. It is this cultural constitution," he writes, "which with the passage of time is subject to change and which determines to a very large extent the relationship between the individual and society. Modern anthropology has taught us through comparative investigation of so-called primitive cultures that the social behavior of human beings may differ greatly depending on prevailing cultural patterns and types of organization which predominate in society. It is on this that those who are striving to improve the lot of man may ground their hopes. Human beings are not condemned because of their biological constitution to annihilate each other or to be at the mercy of a cruel, self-inflicted fate." I like that. That's the part of socialism that I like. It's the belief, so often proved, of the potential of humanity. Great potential in each individual, great potential in collective action. But returning to Albert Einstein's text, if we ask ourselves how the structure of society and the cultural attitude of man should be changed in order to make human life as satisfying as possible, We should constantly be conscious of the fact that there are certain conditions which we are unable to modify. As mentioned before, the biological nature of man is, for all practical purposes, not subject to change. Furthermore, technological and demographic developments of the last few centuries have created conditions which are here to stay in relatively densely settled populations with the goods which are indispensable to their continued existence, an extreme division of labor, and a highly centralized productive apparatus are absolutely necessary. The time, which looking back seems so idyllic, is gone forever when individuals or relatively small groups could be completely self-sufficient. It is only a slight exaggeration to say that mankind constitutes, even now, a planetary community of production and consumption. I have now reached a point, Einstein wrote, where I may indicate briefly what to me constitutes the essence of the crisis of our time. It concerns the relationship of the individual to society. The individual has become more conscious than ever of his dependence upon society, but he does not experience this dependence as a positive asset, as an organic tie, as a protective force, but rather as a threat to his natural rights, or even to his economic existence. Moreover, his position in society is such that the egotistical drives of his makeup are constantly being accentuated, while his social drives, which are by nature weaker, progressively deteriorate. All human beings, whatever their position in society, are suffering from this process of deterioration. Unknowingly, prisoners of their own egotism, they feel insecure, lonely, and deprived of the naive, simple, and unsophisticated enjoyment of life. Man can find meaning in life, short and perilous as it is, only through devoting himself to society. Einstein, in writing that, almost seems to criticize the MAGA crowd. Unknowing prisoners of their own egotism. They feel insecure, lonely, and deprived. Surely they do. And I think that Einstein's analysis of society is well thought out and rather deep. So I continue with his writings. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. The number to call with your comments and questions about socialism, 503-231-8187. The economic anarchy, Einstein wrote, of capitalist society as it exists today is, in my opinion, the real source of the evil. We see before us a huge community of producers, the members of which are unceasingly striving to deprive each other of the fruits of their collective labor, not by force, but on the whole, in faithful compliance with legally established rules. In this respect, it is important to realize that the means of production, that is to say, the entire productive capacity that is needed for producing consumer goods as well as additional capital goods, may legally be, and for the most part are, the private property of individuals. For the sake of simplicity in the discussion that follows, I shall call workers all those who do not share in the ownership of the means of production. Although this does not quite correspond to the customary use of the term, the owner of the means of production is in a position to purchase the labor power of the worker. By using the means of production, the worker produces new goods, which then become the property of the capitalist. The essential point about this process is the relation between what the worker produces and what he is paid, both measured in terms of real value. Insofar as the labor contract is free, he puts that word in scare quotes, what the worker receives is determined not by the real value of the goods he produces, but by his minimum needs and by the capitalist requirement for labor power in relation to the number of workers competing for jobs. It is important to understand that even in theory, the payment of the worker is not determined by the value of his product. Now, departing from that, in the case of the Burgerville workers, this is the case, and it is, as I was saying, the first lie that the capitalist apologists like to come up with, saying that, well, if you're sympathetic with the workers there at Burgerville, sure, they like to get higher wages, but do you want to pay more for the burger? That is not how it works. The price of the burger is going to be set by supply and demand. Absolutely, simply. Even the Chicago economists would agree with me on that. And as I said, it may be raised as a way of socially retaliating, but certainly not as a necessity. And what Einstein is talking about in the preceding section, paragraph, is the fact that when you work for a capitalist, your work is not rewarded in any relation to what you're producing. It is simply rewarded on the basis of how desperate you are in relation to other people who wish to do the same work. Now, returning to Einstein, private capital tends to be concentrated in a few hands, partly because of competition among the capitalists, and partly because technological development and the increasing division of labor encourage the formation of larger units of production at the expense of the smaller ones. The result of these developments is an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked, even by a democratically organized political society. This is true since the members of the legislative bodies are selected by political parties, largely financed or otherwise influenced by private capitalists, who for all practical purposes separate the electorate from the legislature. The consequence is that the representatives of the people do not, in fact, sufficiently protect the interests of the underprivileged sections of the population. Moreover, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control directly or indirectly the main sources of information, the press, the radio, the education, and, of course, post-Einstein, I would add the internet. It is thus extremely difficult, and indeed in most cases quite impossible, for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and make intelligent use of his political rights. Again, apart from Einstein's words, that is why I do press watch the news you're not supposed to know. This is why we have community radio. This is why community radio is under attack. Community radio often slides to the left, because we commit ourselves to analysis, because we are here for the people, we are of the people in the first place, and we are not here to kiss up to the capitalists. So what happens? We are leftists. Not entirely, just a fair infusion of us. We are abolitionists, we are leftists, we are progressive. And that is sufficient for us to be infiltrated, spied upon. There's a long history of this. Community radio stations, the Pacifica stations, going back to their founding after the Second World War, right around the time that Einstein was writing what I've been reading. They're not socialist organizations, but they tolerate socialists, and that is sufficient for the state to be terrified of them. The fact that I am here talking about socialism is enough to generate the hatred and the undermining efforts and the threats that community radio has faced since the beginning. Occupy Wall Street terrified the powers that be, absolutely terrified them. And they were infiltrated. We know now that the FBI had its own organization meeting with heads of capitalism, making certain that there was extensive infiltration and undermining of that little effort, which was about the redistribution of wealth. Whenever you hear that Occupy was too vague, we don't know what they were about, and that's because it's taboo to think that it was about the redistribution, the rational redistribution, the rational and moral redistribution of the maldistribution of wealth in this country. That's all Occupy was about, and that was enough for it to be torn apart by the powers that be. Naomi Klein has written about this. But I've been talking about socialism, and I'm very glad to be here at KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM, where you can actually hear the word socialism. And I think it's something we definitely need to talk about. I'm getting towards the end of Einstein's writing on this, and I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say about socialism. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Einstein wrote, "The situation prevailing in an economy based on the private ownership of capital is thus characterized by two main principles. First, means of production, capital, are privately owned. The owners dispose of them as they see fit. Second, the labor contract is free." Of course, there is no such thing as pure capitalist society in this sense. In particular, it should be noted that the workers, through long and bitter political struggles, have succeeded in securing a somewhat improved form of the free labor contract for certain categories of workers. But taken as a whole, the present-day economy does not much differ from pure capitalism. And I'm going to take another call, but I want to comment that in 1949, the situation was quite different. The Soviet Union was accumulating some wealth and distributing it in such a way that it was viewed as a threat, to the point that Eisenhower as president, was deferential to the concept of socialism and was determined to make the capitalist contract so well reformed and the wealth so well distributed that it would be impossible for the communists to take hold in the United States. And it is indeed because of that legitimacy of communism that was perceived at the time by many that Einstein was not openly attacked for his socialism. Einstein was a commie. He wasn't kidding. And that has changed now. Trump certainly does not fear any legitimacy from the equivalent of a Soviet Union. It's not there anymore. And the Soviet Union collapsed for various reasons. Its own contradictions, certainly, but also from the wars. Most people don't understand that when the Soviet Union was first coming together, when the Bolsheviks first won power, millions of people died fighting the white armies from eight nations. Eight nations pooled their money together to stamp out the idea of socialism. And it was that war which deformed and frightened the remaining Bolsheviks into the totalitarian society that only a couple of decades later was shaking hands with Hitler. What a pity. What a shame. It's time to start again. And John's on the air. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have a bit of good news from the... I heard on NPR this morning. New York State is taking the Trump Foundation and Trump to court over all his thievery. So that's interesting. And I have personal... I was a Jesus person back in the late 60s, early 70s, so I was interested in the Book of Acts. I think that was my favorite book. It advocated equality to the point of if anybody hoarded anything, they were pretty hammered pretty hard. So this is the...
Yeah, St. Paul's communes were just that. That's what the tithe was about. Everyone kicked down so they can get their basics covered.
Yeah, well, there's a rediscovered gospel that makes it even more clear that Jesus advocated equality for all. And it's called the Gospel of the Nazarenes, rediscovered in a Tibetan monastery about 1870. So there's pretty interesting stuff there. Yeah, Jesus was advocating spiritual communalism.
Okay for Jeezy, then.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I've been reading from Albert Einstein's 1949 Defense of Socialism. Getting towards the end of it, and I'll be returning to it in a moment. Right now, I'd like to talk to Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Teresa. You're on a roll. It's great. I love hearing the reference to rations and rationalism. I think that's a real word for both. Rations. It means a mindful, meaningful, rational distribution to make sure everybody's okay and the whole is stronger.
Yeah, I'd be okay with a collectively determined distribution of wealth. And I think it would be something like people who are really motivated and really productive and admirable would earn three times as much as the base rate. But we pay people 1,000 and more times. And the people that we pay are simply the efflorescence of the elite. The captains of industry, the CEO, are paid simply to... They're paid in genuflection to their decision power, and their labor is in no way comparable to their compensation.
Well, it's the same reason why the nobility in medieval times and other times needed to pay for capitals to protect them because of how they were treating people. So,
yeah, because if you really look at it, if analysis is applied, it doesn't stand up.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for calling in. And I think I have another call. Walker is on the air. Hi, Walker.
Hello. I was calling to suggest that it's great that Einstein grounded the so-called human individual in the social context, but he never got around to grounding humanity into a natural context. He didn't find a place for humanity as part of the natural order. It left it kind of floating free to do what it wanted, and I think that's probably has a lot to do with all the trouble the domesticated people are in today.
Were you listening earlier when I read from Einstein saying, it is evident, therefore, that the dependence of the individual upon society is a fact of nature which cannot be abolished?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He did acknowledge that, but he didn't acknowledge that humanity as a species has a place within the natural order that, apart from which it's not viable.
I think that's contradicted by what I just read, but thank you for your opinion. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I am reading from Albert Einstein's article in Monthly Review 1949, Defending Socialism. Production, he wrote, is carried on for profit, not for use. There is no provision that all those able and willing to work will always be in a position to find employment. An army of unemployed almost always exists. The worker is constantly in fear of losing his job. Since unemployed and poorly paid workers do not provide a profitable market, the production of consumers' goods is restricted and great hardship is the consequence. Technological progress frequently results in more unemployment rather than an easing of the burden of work for all. The profit motive, in conjunction with competition among capitalists, is responsible for an instability in the accumulation and utilization of capital, which leads to increasingly severe depressions. Unlimited competition leads to a huge waste of labor and to that crippling of the social consciousness of individuals, which I mentioned before. The crippling of individuals, I consider the worst evil of capitalism. Our whole educational system suffers from this evil. An exaggerated competitive attitude is inculcated into the student who is trained to worship acquisitive success as a preparation for his future career. I am convinced, Einstein wrote, there is only one way to eliminate these grave evils, namely through the establishment of a socialist economy, accompanied by an educational system which would be oriented towards social goals. In such an economy, the means of production are owned by society itself and are utilized in a planned fashion. A planned economy, which adjusts production to the needs of the community, would distribute the work to be done among all those able to work and would guarantee a livelihood to every man, woman, and child. The education of the individual, in addition to promoting his own innate abilities, would attempt to develop in him a sense of responsibility for his fellow men, sexist language from 1949, for his fellow men in place of the glorification of power and success in our present society. And I have someone else waiting to comment. Harry's on the air. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The comment I have to make is when I went to Portland State, I took a Western Civilization course, and one of the required books was The Day They Bombed Moscow. During the White Army and the Red Army, when they were fighting, Britain was very involved. In fact, British planes actually bombed Moscow. And I was shocked to hear this. And also, during this time, United States occupied Siberia until we were forced out. We were there for 3 or 4 years. But the Russian Army forced us out. And it's part of American history that we don't like to talk about.
You're absolutely right. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, coming to the end of Einstein's comments on socialism. Nevertheless, he wrote, it is necessary to remember that a planned economy is not yet socialism. A planned economy as such may be accompanied by the complete enslavement of the individual. The achievement of socialism requires the solution of some extremely difficult social political problems. How is it possible, in view of the far-reaching centralization of political and economic power, to prevent bureaucracy from becoming all-powerful and overweening? How can the rights of the individual be protected and therewith a democratic counterweight to the power of bureaucracy be assured? Clarity about the aims and problems of socialism is of greatest significance in our age of transition. Since under present circumstances, Einstein wrote, free and unhindered discussion of these problems has come under a powerful taboo, I consider the foundation of this magazine, he's talking about a monthly review, to be an important public service. And that's the end of Albert Einstein's comments on socialism. You're invited to add your comments, 503-231-8187. Let me quote Michael Perini on socialism for a moment. He wrote, real socialism, it is argued, would be controlled by the workers themselves through direct participation instead of being run by Leninists, Stalinists, Castroites, or other ill-willed, power-hungry, bureaucratic cabals of evil men who betray revolutions. Unfortunately, this pure socialism view is ahistorical and non-falsifiable. It cannot be tested against the actualities of history. It compares an ideal against an imperfect reality, and the reality comes off a poor second. It imagines what socialism would be like in a world far better than this one, where no strong state structure, or security force is required, where none of the value produced by workers needs to be expropriated to rebuild society and defend it from invasion and internal sabotage, end quote. That's from Black Shirts and Reds by Michael Perini. And it reminds me of what I was saying earlier about the need to defend community radio. For example, KBOO radio was recently attacked by hackers who converted the computer system here. Our entire multi-trillion bit home servers into Bitcoin miners. And not only did they do that, but they introduced code so malicious that it could not effectively be purged for more than, it was weeks. And this is by people who knew what they were doing. So the system here, which is half of our audience, the server here, and certainly the live stream for a while, was attacked and put to capitalist uses. But that code, as I said, was so malicious that I believe it would undermine a purely capitalist intent. In other words, a rational capitalist seeking to pirate the KBOO server, as was done, might well put in malicious, it was malicious code from the get-go, but it knocked the server so down so consistently and so swiftly that I should think that if someone really wanted to mine Bitcoin off the KBOO server, they would have put in code that, whereas it might have reconstituted itself at some point, wouldn't do so constantly. What I'm saying here is that there is a context of attacks on KBOO radio. And I've been here for decades, and I'm familiar. We have been infiltrated from time to time. And this is on the basis of the fact that we simply support reform. We support the abolition of whiteness. KBOO tolerates socialists like myself, speaking specifically about socialism, and that is enough to attract the fury of the anti-democratic forces of capitalism, the secret police agencies of the United States. And we have learned to deal with it. For example, I have often broadcast the one of the techniques that is one of the favorites is the snitch jacket, in which after hearing something like what I just said, the infiltrator of an organization then creates an authentic-looking document and plants it, or these days it's a file, and plants it to make it look like someone who is not involved in infiltration, someone who is completely innocent, is in fact working, and preferably this is someone who is essential to the organization, is in fact working for the secret police when, the actual secret police worker is hiding themselves. So you have to be aware of snitch jacketing, and you have to make it backfire as best you can. And when you find that someone you're working with has utterly betrayed you and is from the secret police, you'd best doubt it. Prima facie, you'd best doubt it, because it's not that easy usually. I've got a caller. I think this will be the last caller. So go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey.
Hi.
I had a comment on your previous caller. I don't think you kind of got what he was saying.
Yeah, I might have missed that.
I think, if I got it right, I think he's saying that man has made himself dependent upon society, which it sort of correlates with what Einstein's saying. But that's because we've separated ourselves out from the natural order of things. We think we're separate from all the rest of creation, if you will,
Yep,
we're not just another animal.
That is exactly Einstein's point, yeah.
Oh, okay, great. I didn't hear the beginning of the show, but I caught him and... Well, great. Then I think we're all on the same page.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for calling in. Well, you've been listening to Press Watch. I've been talking about socialism, and you will be able to, since we have contracted with an outside server, I think at this point, in any event, however it works out, you will be able to listen to the show in its entirety. Within about half an hour, you can find it at kboo.fm. And the way that you find it is to put in kboo.fm/presswatch. Or use the search engines in the various ways on kboo.fm to find it. And so we are broadcasting now on 90.7 FM in Cascadia, other frequencies in the Cascadian region, at 25,000 watts out to you, and thanks to your support. And we are broadcasting at kboo.fm to all the ships at sea.
Come now, morning, everybody. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59, about to be 10 o'clock. Up next, we have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers with David Naiman. Talks to author Sheila Haidee, who asks, what is gained and what is lost when a woman becomes a mother in her new novel, Motherhood? At 11:30, Words and Pictures talks to sculptor, composer, and animator John Frame about his work on Portland Opera's new production of Faust. We want to thank KBOO members for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Four Peaks Music Festival, taking place Thursday, June 21st through Sunday, June 24th in Bend, Oregon. The 11th annual Four Peaks Music Festival features two stages, a kids area, and a junction area for gathering and jamming. Performers include Green Sky Bluegrass, the North Mississippi All-Stars, Poor Man's Whiskey, Molly Tuttle, and many, many more. Again, that's the Four Peaks